Hi, my name is Sydney, and I'm sort of fucked up this week.
Hi, my name is Maya. She's in my shoes now. Except I don't ever say that I fucked up. It's that I was intentional.
No, like, it's still going to be a good episode, but I just went to go check the date for something that I was like, oh, like, we're doing, like, a fun little promotion for a new thing, and then I was like, oh, that doesn't come out till next month, actually. And for some reason, I processed it wrong, and now we're here. But welcome to Canonically Incorrect, your always perfect,
yeah, all the never, time. Never once have me, Maya specifically, fucked up in any regard or made anyone upset about anything regarding any fandom ever. I'm the perfect fandom content creator. I'm so sorry.
No, you're totally valid for everything that you're saying right now. We're a fandom. We talk about everything and everything fanfiction. So before I get into today's episode and talk about how my fuck up happened and how I didn't realize it until about 5 seconds before hitting record today.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the fuck up from earlier, not like...
No.
I didn't know that there was a separate fuck up. Never mind. I'm interested to hear what this is about.
Yeah, of course. You looked at me with so scared.
Because you're like the well put together one, whereas me, I'm just like running around.
But I would like to thank a donor that we had, Kate. Thank you so much for donating to our Ko-fi. We really appreciate it. If you guys are listening to us right now and like us and want to support us, Maya and I have lots of fun plans that we would love to do. But in order to do those, we need money.
The world runs on cash.
Yes, so you can either give us a one-time donation at ko-fi.com/canonicallyincorrect, or you can follow us on Patreon for a monthly donation and a bunch of cool bonus content that we have. I think we have like 30 episodes of bonus content now. Yeah. We have polls from time to time so that you can influence the main show. We have a Discord. You know, we have bunch of fun things, and now we're offering free trials. So if you would like to have a 7-day free trial.
Whoa, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, Patreon gave us the option, and I was like, why not? So if you would like a free trial to see what's going on, listen to a couple of our bonus episodes, see if you like us, and stick around. Talking about our Patreon, a fun little roundup of what we did last month. So Maya, what did you do last month on the Patreon?
I delayed my episode by a week so I could give my first impressions of the new Zelda game, Tears of the Kingdom, which I talked about in my main episode. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I gave my initial, hey, played about 6 hours worth this weekend, went through like the tutorial.
Which is a drop in the bucket, but...
So yeah, my whole spiel, my episode last month was my initial review on the game.
Very fun. Yeah. And then for my solo episode, I talked about the musical Fangirls, which somebody recommended to me, slid in our little DMs and was just like, hey, y'all ever heard about an Australian musical called Fangirls? And I was like, no, but please tell me all about it. And since then, I've been obsessed, and I talked about it. I talked about the making of Fangirls, what caused the creator Eve Blake to make Fangirls. I talked about the plot. I talked about the music in there. I unfortunately could not find like any way to watch it, and it's Australian, so it's not like, I mean, there might be a bootleg out there. I don't know. But so I just listened to like the cast recordings and talked about the cast recordings and everything, and I just talked about how much I loved it. And then on our joint episode, we did a fun Legend of Zelda Smasher Pass.
Yes, yeah, so you put it together.
I did put a fun little PowerPoint together that we talked about Tears of the Kingdom, Breath of the Wild, and a bunch of other miscellaneous important characters of Zelda. We smashed her past, and it was quite fun. We had a really good time.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, so if you would like to try that out, we have a free trial for the Wattpad Well-Wisher tier, which is our $5 tier, which you can get a bunch of bonus content. So that one's a 7-day free trial if you would like to try that out right now and listen to see what characters from Legend of Zelda Maya and I would smash and or pass. So anyways, do you want to learn how I fucked up this month?
I'm a little scared to.
It's nothing bad, but...
Okay.
I still have an episode put together. Everything's fine for a regular episode. But I learned that the second season of Good Omens was coming out.
Correct.
And so I was like, oh my god, I'm going to put a fun little episode together to talk about the second season of Good Omens. Because, like, people should be very excited. It's the second season. First season came out a very long time ago.
Right.
It's a great show, XYZ, they're very popular on Our Cup of Our Own, right?
Yep.
And then I was just like, perfect, it's coming out soon. My brain said June. Do you know what's not coming out in June?
Good Omens.
The second season of Good Omens.
Yeah.
It's in fact coming out July 28th.
Oh, exciting.
So this episode's a little early. And then guess, because I was like, oh, you know what? I should figure out what the exact day that the new season is coming out. So I look up, put in my little, when is the second season? Oh, July. Oh, so I can't even scramble to put together a new episode and wait until next month to, no.
No.
I found this out 15 seconds before we hit record.
Very cool.
So I would all love for you to listen to this and then listen to it one more time in the month of July to celebrate the second season of Good Omens.
Yeah, man.
Because someone fucked up. Whoops. But
wonder who that was.
Hey. But it'll totally be fine. Today I have the fanfiction Inkblots and Forget-Me-Nots by Guts and Glitter to read to you today.
Okay.
It is a Good Omens fanfiction.
Mm-hmm.
It is obviously Aziraphale and Crowley. It was written in July 3rd, 2019 and finished on January 11th, 2020. It is 12 chapters, 42,000 words. It is teen and up audience. Around 10,000 hits, 1,600 kudos, 500 comments, and 356 bookmarks. And some of the tags are Human AU, Alternate Universe Flower Shop and Tattoo Parlor.
Mm-hmm.
Love that trope. That's one of my favorites up there. Crisis of Faith, Internalized Homophobia, Getting Back Together, Angst and Fluff and Flowers, and a Pet Snake named Alistair. Friends to Lovers to Enemies to Lovers. No Smut, We Slow Burn Like Jane Austen.
Very cool.
I love a good flower shop, tattoo shop. I think the dichotomy is perfect. I think specifically with, like, this pairing, the ineffable husbands pairing.
Mm-hmm.
Really love them. I'm going to put a little, like, warning. Ding. Because the show is what it is. And it's, you know, angels and demons and a lot of religious text. I don't know if it's all this way in the fandom. It could be just because of what the show is.
Right.
This fic is very poignant on, like, how, religions make people of the LGBT community feel. They can get pretty, like, triggering for some people who have experienced religious trauma and, you know, homophobia in the church and just in general. Be wary of that. You have watched the show, right?
Yeah, I've seen the first season. I do really like it. I have not. I know that there's a book, correct?
Yeah, by Neil Gaiman.
Yeah, I have not read it. Okay. I would like to. Fine. Like, I do, like, his stuff in general, so. But yeah, I did watch it when it first came out. The show, sweet, from what I remember, was really good.
The show's so good.
Like, the show's, I remember liking, so good. It so much. And I think that's mainly because, like, the cast.
Yeah. Love David Tennant. Love David Tennant.
Love David Tennant.
Love David Tennant. Can't wait to see him in that role again, gotta be honest. Yeah. He's really good in that role.
Yeah.
I understand why the show is as big as it is because of the dynamic between, like, the two main characters. Right. And, like, the chemistry between the actors. They're great together.
Well, I also think, not to be like that, I think everyone has, like, some form of religious trauma.
Oh, for sure.
Whether that be, like, they are actively within their religion, you know, successful, thriving, they like their religion. I still think that, like, growing as a person requires you to, like, kind of go through, like, a mental thing involving religion in any way, shape, or form. So I think it's an easy thing for people to be like, yeah, that makes sense, because it's it's not specifically, like, I know there's, like, oh, God, and it's not, like, Islam or Judaism or anything like that, like, specific, and it is leaning more towards, like, Catholic.
Catholic, oh, yeah, for sure.
Catholic faith.
Yeah.
But it is still, like, we all know the stories. We all are very aware of, like, Adam, Eve, Jesus, like, the big ones.
Yes.
So,
the man upstairs.
Yeah, like, we all kind of know who he is.
Yes.
Regardless if you believe in him or not. So I think it's an easy thing to be like, hey, funny little twist. It's funny, haha. Isn't that exciting? Yeah. And you're like, yeah, okay, right, I'm behind that.
I'm excited to see what it is, just because I don't know if, like, any of season two follows the book, because there's only one book. It's, like, a standalone.
Yeah, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I think it's purely just, like,
yeah.
I
But I know that Neil Gaiman is behind it in some way, shape, or form.
Oh,
like,
very cool.
Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. It's just a very fun show. I'm glad the second season's coming out. This is my first dive into the fan fiction.
Mm.
I've never read the fan fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like the show was enough, but I understand when people are like, I want them together. And I was like, you know what? I get it. Neil Gaiman gets it. I remember the actor who plays Aziraphale. I remember he was on some talk show and they were talking about the fan fiction and he was just like, good on them. Great. And then I remember like my side of Twitter like blew up being like, he says it's okay. He says he likes it. Oh my God.
Good for them.
And then obviously Neil Gaiman is a giant, giant fan fiction supporter. No other author, to my knowledge, is as big as a fan fiction supporter as Neil Gaiman is.
Fuck yeah.
I who can forget the greatest comeback of all time when someone was just like, but like, you're an author. Wouldn't you fucking hate fan fiction? And he was like, well, considering I won like a, like some prestigious prize for like, basically something that's like H.P. Lovecraft fan fiction. How could I possibly ever hate it?
Right.
So we love Neil Gaiman in this house. We love Good Omens season 2. And I hope that you guys enjoy this about a month early to get ready for the second season of Good Omens. We first opened in the year 2019, and Aziraphale is working at his flower shop. He is a hopeless romantic, and to him, flowers are a love language of their own, and he loves being a provider of them. Over the course of his career, he has done hundreds of weddings and funerals and provided arrangements for parents, lovers, and friends. But early in his career, he learned that a not insignificant portion of his customer base was made up of people who were not happily in love, but adulterers and ill-behaved lovers who used flowers as apologies.
Mm-hmm.
And Aziraphale wouldn't have minded or even have known, except so many of them felt the need to share everything with him. They would talk forever as Aziraphale arranged their cheap and ill-thought-out apology. Every one of these interactions leaves Aziraphale feeling emotionally drained and makes him think what a fool he'd been when he first started working at the shop as an idealistic, starry-eyed, love-struck fool. Thankfully, his friend Madame Tracy pays him a visit that day. She brings a baked good and cocoa from the nearby shop while listening to his woes. There's a lid for every pot, I suppose, Aziraphale finishes. And how about you? Any chance I could tempt you into letting me play matchmaker? No, no, thank you, but no. You and I both know that was all over for me a long time ago. There's a glance out the window at Ninth Circle, Inc., a tattoo shop across the road which was owned and operated by Aziraphale's ex-lover. Madame Tracy says, such a pity that you two can't work things out. I'm sure you made a darling couple. Well, that's one word for it, but no. After 15 years, I'm afraid it's really not a matter of just working things out. I know, but still, I want you to be happy, dear. I am happy. I have my shop, I have my friends, I have access to exquisite pastries. I have a very full life. And for the most part, he means it. Sometime after Madame Tracy leaves, the bell above the front door chimes. A young boy, around the age of 11, enters the shop, followed by a small black and white terrier. He's looking for flowers for his mother's birthday. As Aziraphale's putting together a bouquet of periwinkle hydrangeas together, the front door chimes again, and Aziraphale looks up, only to immediately grimace as Anthony J. Crowley, proud owner of Ninth Circle Inc., walks in. He does his best to ignore him as Crowley is Crowley. He's there to drop off some mail that was misdelivered to his shop, but he doesn't leave after his task is done. Instead, he goes about his shop, misting the flowers and stating, "What would you ever do without me, love?" When Adam has received the flowers and left the shop, Aziraphale snaps at Crowley for acting and talking and maybe even flirting, even though Crowley would never say that, to Aziraphale in front of a customer. Not long after, Crowley leaves the shop. Aziraphale couldn't help but watch as he made his way across the road and through the weathered front door of Ninth Circle, Inc. It was hardly more than a stone's throw from the flower shop. It had been the perfect arrangement in the beginning. He remembered the first time a cheating husband had come into the shop, how after the customer had left, Aziraphale had dashed across the street in 10 seconds flat. Midway through recounting the story, he began to cry, and Crowley had taken him into his arms and pressed a kiss to his forehead. Aziraphale tore himself away from the window, swallowing as he felt the old hurt begin to surface that he knew would linger with him throughout the rest of the day. So this fic, being 12 chapters long, it changes from chapter to chapter. It's like every odd chapter is 2019, and every even chapter is from the past. So 1990 onwards, like from, it's like their backstory. Okay. So in 1990 is when Aziraphale and Crowley meet for the first time. Outside of a hospital. Aziraphale is studying to be a priest, which means performing last rites. To anybody who doesn't know, Christians and Catholics, they do this thing called the last rites, which is like your last means of entry into heaven. It's the last for a priest to come and say, like, please God, let this person who is, like, clearly dying in the hospital into heaven. Like, let your son and or daughter be let into heaven. So those are last rites.
Interesting.
Yes. Aziraphale, who's training to be a priest, has to perform these last rites. And he just had to perform his first last rites on a preteen girl who had been sick half of her life. The moment he could, he escaped the situation, running outside to the cold January air. And then he hears, "You look like you're having a worse day than I am." Aziraphale turns and sees a man leaning against a cement pillar. He's tall and slender, with shoulder-length red hair and a battered leather jacket, and his head is wrapped in bandages. "Well, maybe. I'm not sure. It's just all a bit much." "Yeah, hospitals are like that sometimes. There's just so much hopelessness. I thought I'd be able to help more." "You a doctor?" "Priest. Well, priest in training." "And you thought you were going to be helpful? The only way your lot could be helpful around here is if you stayed the fuck away and let actual doctors do their job." And Aziraphale is speechless. No one has ever said anything like that to him. And also, who is this person to say these things to him? But at the same time, he knows he has a head injury, so maybe he's just talking to talk because he has no idea what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
And Aziraphale says, "Should you really be smoking after a traumatic brain injury? That doesn't seem exactly wise." And the man says, "Listen, if I wanted medical advice, I'll ask a bloody doctor. If I want to start talking to an imaginary friend in the sky, you're my man." And Aziraphale, who's clearly not getting through to this man, marches back inside the hospital. And Aziraphale meets this man again by chance 2 weeks later at a pub that he works at. The man, Crowley, doesn't remember him at all, accounting for his head injury, but he does apologize for any assholery that he probably did. And after that night, Aziraphale becomes a regular at this pub. One night, Crowley gives him a ride home. The ride is mostly silent, and soon they are pulling up to Aziraphale's dorm. He fumbles with the door handle, and Crowley leans across to assist him. For a few moments, he was close, dangerously close. Crowley's hair was still tied back, and a sliver of moonlight fell across his pale throat, which was just centimeters away from Aziraphale's lips. He realized if he leaned forward ever so slightly, he could press a kiss to the soft spot behind Crowley's ear. He feels a sudden urge to reach out, just to touch, but he doesn't. He slides out of the car, shutting the door, and hurrying to the hall without looking back. He thinks about Crowley a lot after this moment. Months pass, and Aziraphale is still working on his priesthood, though it is getting harder. Visiting Crowley at the bar when he can. On a particularly rough day, he visits when he normally wouldn't, and Crowley gives him all of his attention. He walks Aziraphale home that night, wrapping his arm around Aziraphale for support since they've both been drinking. At least that's what he thought, until Crowley says, "Yeah, can't say I mind it much either. Not exactly how I pictured it happening, but I'm not complaining." And it takes a solid minute for Crowley's words to register, and Aziraphale slows to a stop. You've pictured holding me? Yeah, sort of. A little. Did you? Yes. And Crowley tips his head forward and leans in, gently brushing the tip of his nose against Aziraphale's, and that delicate, tender touch sends a sharp shock through Aziraphale's system. And then reality comes crashing through this alcohol fog with a violent fury, shattering this moment. I know what's happening. Well, I should hope so. It seems fairly obvious. This is a test. What? You were sent to tempt me, to test my faith. What was I? Yes, and it won't work. I am not going to give into temptation. Are you saying that I'm heaven sent? No, hell sent. Either way, it won't work. Why are you so sure about that? And Crowley leans forward and raises a hand towards Aziraphale's face. Crowley gently runs the pad of his thumb along Aziraphale's bottom lip. The touch is so delicate, an act of intimacy like nothing Aziraphale has ever experienced before. Before he has time to react, Crowley drops his hand. Aziraphale finds himself leaning forward as if to chase the warmth of the other man's thumb. That's what I thought. So Aziraphale is training in priesthood. Priests are not even supposed to have, like, any form of, like, human connection. They don't get married. They don't do anything, mm-hmm. let alone, like, fall in love with the same sex. We're going back to the year 1990 when they first meet, which is a very different time than 2019 where the fic finishes.
A little bit.
There's a lot of this in the fic of, like, especially in the background chapters, I guess, like the chapters from their past, because it is like Aziraphale actively going through like these thoughts of like, maybe I don't want to do this. I don't know what's happening. I don't know what these feelings are. Oh my God. Like, everyone's telling me that they're wrong. Right. So I think it's very interesting. I think especially talking about, you know, people write fan fiction to one form of community, but also like to talk about their struggles in life. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe Good Omens, like the show, helped, or at least gave a platform and like a setting for authors to like go in and play in and talk about their religious trauma in a way.
Right.
So I think that's interesting. I think I would love to know if that's like a running theme within Good Omens, or if it's just like a couple, just because of what the show is all about, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So in 2019, Aziraphale is going about his day making bouquets for customers that come in. And then halfway through the day, the young boy from before returns. His name is Adam, and he returned to thank Aziraphale for the flowers, as his mother loved them. And Aziraphale thanks the boy and lets him know that he can stay in the shop a bit longer if he'd like. He makes tea and brings out some biscuits, and when he returns, he finds the boy looking at a bunch of his books. You know, what each flower means, and, you know, what they want to say in an arrangement. And Adam's very fascinated with the book, so Aziraphale lets him borrow it as long as, you know, he returns it. And true to his word, Adam comes back a few days later to return the book, only to end up walking out with one, two more, and this becomes a regular occurrence. Aziraphale finds more books to give to Adam while he becomes slightly obsessed with this new knowledge. And after a while, he becomes a kind of permanent fixture at the flower shop. He would come in every few days, usually spending an hour or so talking to Aziraphale or helping him out with tasks around the shop, and Aziraphale quite enjoys the company. And Adam has also spent some time over at Ninth Circle Inc., where he was allowed to watch Crowley work, which Aziraphale doesn't love, but Crowley does promise that he would not give the boy a tattoo until he's 18 or brings in a convincing enough fake ID. And on one July day, Crowley comes waltzing inside to the flower shop with more misdelivered mail, and they act the same way they did the last time Adam saw them in the same room together. Aziraphale exasperated with Crowley, and Crowley fucking around, slightly flirting, and yet annoying him at the same time. And when Crowley leaves, Adam asks Aziraphale why he and Crowley hate each other. And Aziraphale says, "Hate each other? What makes you think that we hate each other? Don't you? You two are always arguing, and when he leaves the room, you seem so sad." "No, my dear boy, I don't hate Mr. Crowley. He may very well hate me. He has every right to, you see. And he trails off, quite unsure how to have this conversation with an 11-year-old boy. And then Adam asks, "Well, was he your boyfriend?" And Aziraphale says, "Yes, I suppose that would be an appropriate term." And he says, "It's complicated. In any event, some harsh words were said and we parted ways." "Well, you didn't go very far, though," Adam points out. And Aziraphale has to smile. "No, I suppose we did not." And back in 1990, the day after Crowley tried to kiss or tempt Aziraphale, he falls sick. All day when he's laid in bed, he can't stop thinking of Crowley. He doesn't know what to make of the man in any way. He insulted him, said he was hell-sent, and then made sure he got home and thought about holding him. It's all very confusing. For the first time in his life, Aziraphale had doubts. Doubts about himself, doubts about his church, doubts about his future. He had once prided himself on his perfect faith, on his belief in evidence of things not seen. And he now found himself questioning everything he had ever thought to be true. Nothing seemed concrete or provable anymore, and without his unshakable moral compass, the world seemed topsy-turvy. Weeks pass, and no matter how much scripture he read or prayers he whispered, Aziraphale still feels lost. He spends nights after sleepless nights tossing and turning as his mind vaulted from one image to another, falling asleep in Crowley's arms, being rejected by the church, making love to Crowley, being seen as a deviant, building a life in a home with Crowley, turning his back on Crowley, and continuing with his studies. And after a while, this exhaustion and this mental fog begin to catch up with him during the day. And it all comes to a head on the day he accidentally gives the last rites to someone who's very much alive and will very much continue to be alive for a very, very long time. So clearly this cannot continue. And that night he decides to do something. So he finds a payphone and he dials Crowley's number. And when Crowley picks up and Aziraphale hears his voice on the other end, just panic overwhelms and paralyzes him. And Crowley's obviously not hearing anything on the other line. So he's like, "Okay, well, I'm going to hang up now." And Aziraphale's like, "No, wait, Crowley. Aziraphale? Yes, I'm sorry to call so late. I hope I'm not disturbing you." Of course not. Is everything okay? Yes. No. I'm not sure. Do you want me to come pick you up? No, no. He doesn't know what he wants. He just knows that hearing Crowley's voice is already calming him in a way that nothing else has had in weeks. And he just sort of trails off as he realizes how poorly thought out this plan was. He isn't really sure what to say. On one end, he wants to say, well, do you remember when you tried to kiss me? I'm afraid it's all gone downhill since then. But he's still very much afraid. So instead, he asks Crowley about his day, and thank God Crowley talks and talks and talks until Aziraphale's supervisor finds him. But before hanging up, Crowley asks when he would see Aziraphale yet, but he cannot answer that question. Knowing he can't bring any of his questions to Crowley, he goes to ask his mentor, Gabriel, about other church members becoming more welcoming to members who are attracted to the same sex. And he says, it's an interesting notion from a sort of philosophical standpoint, because it does seem a little counterintuitive for love to be considered a punishable offense in the eyes of our Lord. Do you see our dissonance changing on the stance on that? Aziraphale's full of anxiety as he waits for any response from Gabriel, and he's stunned when the priest laughs. He says, do I encourage sin? No, Aziraphale, I don't. That's not exactly our MO. And what you're describing isn't love. Those people are deluding themselves if they think that's what it is. And thankfully, Aziraphale doesn't have to be around Gabriel for much longer. He knows that should have settled it. His mentor, his spiritual advisor, who had been chosen to lead him into priesthood, had spoken. But it isn't clarity he's feeling now. It's anger. Those people, that word, those people. There was no empathy, no attempt at understanding, no show of brotherly love in Gabriel's response. Those people, meaning Crowley, meaning Aziraphale. And something deep inside of him snaps, and the months-long confusion dissipates in an instant. He visits Crowley that night, after all the patrons of the pub have left, and it's odd to see Crowley after all this time. They chat like friends for the first few months, but then Crowley asks Aziraphale what he knows was coming. Why are you here? And he tells him. He's there to apologize, he's there to explain, he's there to remind himself that there's no reason to be scared, that Crowley is not scary. What do you want, Aziraphale? You? I want you, probably more than I've ever wanted anything in my life. And Crowley wants him. Has wanted Aziraphale since the second, well, first for Crowley, time Crowley ever saw him. He asks Aziraphale if that's okay. And he says, of course it is. Crowley's gaze drifts down to Aziraphale's lips. Aziraphale raises a hand between them, surprised to see that it wasn't shaking. He looks up into Crowley's eyes, which were so wide and open and trusting, and leans forward. Before he can second-guess himself, he presses his lips to Crowley's and feels the rest of the world melt away. So back to 2019. Recently, Adam has been learning tarot from Madame Tracy. Tracy is a very good conversationalist for the boy, especially when it comes to talking about Aziraphale and Crowley. And on one specific day, when Aziraphale and Crowley are arguing outside the shop, Tracy is more loose-lipped than usual. She says, oh, just kiss and make up already. And Adam asks, you want them to be boyfriends again? Well, not just me, they both want to, but they're too bloody proud to admit it. Mr. Phil said what happened between them was complicated. Not nearly as complicated as they make it out to be. Most of the times, when grown-ups say something is complicated, it really just means that talking about it makes them too sad. So Adam watches as Aziraphale walks back inside the shop, looking like he's trying very hard not to cry. He hates seeing the florist so upset. He was a kind, generous man who went out of his way to make other people happy, and the more Adam thinks about it, the more he realizes that it only makes sense for someone to return the favor. So that night, he meets up with them, his group of children friends, and tells them of this whole story and the plan he's put together of getting them back together. Several days later, a woman walks into the shop, clearly stressed out, and asking if Aziraphale does weddings. He's very excited, he loves weddings, but this woman, Anathema, has not planned a single thing for the wedding. Not a venue, not a dress, not a guest list, nothing. I'm usually super organized about everything, but for some reason, my brain's decided that this is a good time to start procrastinating. I probably would have put this part off even longer, but one of my students recommended you to me. And Aziraphale knows it's Adam before she even says his name. And this changes everything for him. A friend of Adam's is a friend of his. He volunteers not just his flowers for the wedding, but his time to help Anathema plan her wedding. Soon, his flower shop also becomes a wedding planning headquarters. Madame Tracy is more than happy to help, and so is Adam, who brings all of his friends to help him. They spend all of August planning and preparing, and when the last day of the month comes around, Aziraphale is closing up the shop and runs into Crowley when bringing in the outside signs. Shockingly, they have a very pleasant conversation, and Aziraphale doesn't know if it has been a long day of wedding planning or just the way the setting sun catches Crowley's hair and makes it glow, but something makes him wish to continue the conversation. And several beats of silence pass as Aziraphale racks his brains for something to say, something that's not... You know, sometimes I miss you so much that it makes my teeth ache. But he can't think of anything before Crowley makes his move to return to his shop, and Aziraphale can't do anything to stop him. Maybe it's because the flower shop is quiet for the first time in a month, but Aziraphale couldn't stop his thoughts from circling back to Crowley, always Crowley. Here's the thing. He tried to move on. He really, truly tried. He dated other men, kissed other men, he even dated a woman for a short while, but he quickly found that no one else could ever compare. There was no spark with them, no exhilaration, no screaming or fighting or kissing in the rain. They were all not Crowley. He eventually accepted the fact that there could be no one else for him, and that he was likely to love Crowley from a distance for the rest of his life. Still, as he shuffles upstairs to his little flat, what once had been their little flat, he couldn't help but question his own motivations in helping Anathema plan her wedding. Of course, he delighted in helping others, but offering to plan a complete stranger's wedding was a bit much, even for him. Deep down, he wonders if he was, in a way, planning a wedding that he and Crowley could have had. A wedding that they should have had. So back to 1990. We pick up right where we left off, Aziraphale and Crowley ending up at Crowley's apartment to continue making out. But somewhere... in this moment, Crowley stops them, and he doesn't want to push Aziraphale too far. He's already making out with him tonight, but this man, who about 10 minutes ago was a God-fearing straight man, probably also wants to take it very slow. And Aziraphale is very glad that Crowley is the one to say so, and say that he doesn't want just this, but he wants to, like, be with him. Mm-hmm. And he wakes up to Crowley in Crowley's bed, wearing Crowley's clothes the next morning, and seeing him there solidifies all of last night for him. But he's not scared or regretful at all. He's never been more at peace than right now. That is until his alarm to meet with Gabriel goes off, and Aziraphale is panicking and quickly getting ready to have this meeting, and Crowley is panicking himself, panicking about Aziraphale going back to the church after this regarding their decision, and not, you know, seeing him for months on end, never seeing him again. And Aziraphale promises Crowley that he would never do that to him again, but that he wishes that he didn't have to choose. That the church didn't turn its back on him in a time where he needed it the most. And Crowley assures him that whatever decision Aziraphale makes, whatever he goes through, that he'll be right there next to him. About an hour later, Aziraphale walks into Gabriel's office to tell him that he will be leaving and not finishing his studies. Of course, Gabriel asks why Aziraphale made the decision, and he says, "I have fallen in love with a man." Gabriel is very still for a very, very long time. And Aziraphale steels himself for this inevitable reprimand, which doesn't come. Instead, Gabriel laughs as he believes Aziraphale is joking with him, and his stomach sinks. He would have preferred a reprimand, a slap, anything other than Gabriel's cruel laughter. He wishes he did not have to shout in order for Gabriel to believe him. "Aziraphale, if you are not joking, there will be serious consequences." "I understand." That sort of thing is completely unacceptable for a member of the church, let alone a candidate for priesthood. "I understand." "I don't think you do. If you leave, there's no coming back." "Yes, that is rather the point. And if you follow through with this, you're willfully choosing damnation." Aziraphale glances out the window where Crowley waits for him in a parked car. He can see him sitting in the driver's seat, his sunglasses slipping down the bridge of his nose, and his hair still mused from sleep. And oh, if it wasn't the loveliest thing Aziraphale had ever laid eyes on. Something warm and soft bloomed in the center of his chest. If he still harbored any doubts, they flew out the window right then and there. "No, Gabriel. I'm not choosing damnation. I'm choosing love." So back in 2019... it was the last Saturday in September, just over a month before the wedding. Since school started, it had just been Anathema, her fiancé Newt, and Aziraphale planning more, but Adam is still there, despite homework. On this day, the planning gets cut short when Anathema remembers that they have an appointment with Crowley, who scheduled them in last minute to get their wedding bands tattooed. Newt, the fiancé, is very nervous about getting a tattoo, but Adam has to chime in to say that even Aziraphale has a tattoo, so anyone can get one. And Crowley had told the boy about his tattoo. Of course he did. And the whole group is pretty delighted to hear the news. They're like, oh my god, you're so cool. See, Newt, if Aziraphale can do it, you can totally do it. And Newt asks, did it hurt? And he's like, oh, well, not terribly so. And he remembers the tattoo not being comfortable, but what he really remembers is how gentle Crowley was, how supportive he was during the whole process, with kind words and small kisses along the way. You should go with them, Mr. Fell, Adam says, for, you know, moral support. Oh, I'm not sure. That's a good idea. Oh, yeah, you should come with us, Anathema adds. You deserve a break anyways. And Aziraphale hesitates. He hasn't been inside Crowley's shop in years, but he could never say no to Adam and Anathema. It doesn't mean he isn't uncomfortable when he steps inside the shop. He sits silently, preferring to hang out with Crowley's snake while Newt and Anathema get their tattoos done. But the longer that he's there, and the more fun they have in the shop, the more comfortable Aziraphale becomes. Can you guess what tattoo Crowley has? Or not Crowley, Aziraphale has?
I have no idea.
It's pretty sick. Like, it's you're gonna feel so stupid when, like, I say he has angel wings on his back.
Oh, okay. It's like a cross?
No.
What are we talking about?
He has angel wings on his back.
Okay, I understand.
Chapter 8 is a series of snapshots from their lives, 1990 to 2003. So I'm condensing this because it's a lot of life they lived.
Mm-hmm.
They lived together. Aziraphale looks for a job. In fact, this is where Aziraphale gets the job as a floral assistant for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Crowley gets a stick and poke kit and begins his journey of tattooing. They get their shops. Aziraphale goes through a lot mentally, you know, going through the process of being out, struggling religiously. They have fights, misunderstandings, kiss and make up. They go through their best moments together and support each other through the worst. They make friends who love them for they are. They find acceptance. And in 2019, we're back to this tattooing process. And while they were being tattooed, Newt, the fiancé, passes out and hits his head on the floor when he collapsed. And everyone is worrying about him. He's trying to say that he just needs to lie down, but it's Crowley who practically picks him up and takes him to the hospital. Adam goes home while the adults drive to the hospital. Crowley and Aziraphale actually work together as a team to figure out which hospital is best to go to, making sure that the other is okay, especially since the hospital they do go to is the one that Aziraphale's old parish used to work at, the one that he and Crowley first met at. And when they take Newt to be checked, they only allow Anathema to go with him. And Crowley and Aziraphale choose to wait in the waiting room, leaving them to walk down memory lane. Aziraphale reminds Crowley that this is where they first met, recounting the day. He doesn't quite remember, but Aziraphale remembers everything down to the smell of the cigarette smoke. And Crowley lets Aziraphale know that he quit smoking in the time they've broken up. Well, that's quite the achievement, Aziraphale says. Then, because he knows no one else would have said it, he adds, I'm proud of you, Crowley, I really am. And it's an olive branch extended. He offers it with trembling hands and more hope in his heart than he has any right to. And Crowley says, don't. But I mean it. Aziraphale, don't. Just stop. You don't get to say that to me anymore. And the olive branch just dropped. Sadness and regret rushes over Aziraphale. He knows how he wants to answer. Forgive me. I want you to forgive me, to find it in yourself to love me again. I want you to hold me and let me tuck my face into the crook of your neck because it's been 15 years and I've still never found a place that feels as safe as your arms. But he can't say that. It's unfair to ask that of Crowley after so much time had passed. Crowley swears softly under his breath and walks back inside, and only then does Aziraphale allow tears to fall. Wiping out the few rogue tears, he looks up at the sky with a desperate urgency building in his chest. Please, I can't keep doing this. Lord, give me the strength to let him go. I'll return to the church if that's what it takes. Just please let me fall out of love with him. So Maya, I've given you this whole story so far.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is the reason that they broke up?
From what it sounds like Aziraphale is the one that broke,
mm-hmm.
like, fucked up mm-hmm. somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly, like, I feel like it's something to do with the church.
Okay.
Or, like, offending Crowley in some way.
Okay. I mean, they're all good answers. Yeah. I didn't know either. I was, like, going back and forth being, like,
Like, I know that they were, like, oh, complicated is usually something simple that they right. just... So, like, it could be something, like...
Right.
As, quote-unquote, stupid as, like,
mm-hmm.
making a snide joke and it, like, being taken the wrong way.
Sure, sure.
But I honestly don't No.
I mean, again, fair. I was really going back where I was like, oh, I actually don't really know. Like, it feels like, yeah, something's, mm-hmm. just something stupid was said. And this is because that was the way they're making it seem. But right. But we're here now. April 1st, 2004. Aziraphale and Crowley are setting up a picnic. And they've been very busy lately since Aziraphale has been working the flower shop alone after the passing of his mentor and Crowley opening Ninth Circle. And while this is a very nice picnic, Crowley does have other reasons when he hands Aziraphale the newspaper from the day. Maya, do you remember what happened April 1st, 2004?
I was less than three years old.
I know. In the UK, what happened April 1st, 2004 is that gay couples to get joint rights. Gay and lesbian couples are to be given the chance to get similar legal rights to married couples under the new civil partnership bill.
Why'd they do that on April 1st?
I don't know.
What a fucking...
The next day? Just kidding. April Fool's.
I'd kill myself.
JK.
Yeah.
Actually, the whole gay thing, April Fool's joke. We didn't actually give you anything.
Yeah.
So Crowley says, it's kind of like marriage. Not quite the same, but it's a legal recognition and all that jazz. So what do you think? And Aziraphale, who's reading this, is like, what? Well, how about it? How about what? And Crowley laughs a little. Aziraphale. He says, what? Oh! Aziraphale lowers the paper to look at Crowley, who has a small velvet box in his hand, and nestled in the center was a ring, a small silver band edged with gold. And he says, Aziraphale fell, will you enter into a civil partnership with me? And Aziraphale's frozen, believing that this has to be one of Crowley's jokes, or if he was serious, what would a civil partnership even look like? What would they tell people? You know, what would it mean for them? How would they change the relation? How would it change their relationship? And Crowley's smile starts to waver since Aziraphale hasn't answered yet. And he says, it's a yes or no question. Oh, but I'm not sure it's that simple. It is. I'm deeply, stupidly in love with you and want to spend the rest of my life with you. And I would very much like to rent an ill-fitting tux and stand in front of our friends and God as I declare that to the world. I don't see what could be simpler. And suddenly, all of Aziraphale's old fears rise up. Whispers of doubts he's always looked over his shoulder at. Questions of, you know, is this life going to be enough? Am I going to be enough for Crowley? Can't we stay here? I can't take any more change. And Crowley says, after all that, even after everything we've been through, this shouldn't be a question. It's what people do, make vows to each other. If it doesn't matter to you, then why are you so opposed to the idea? Why do you want to change things if you're already happy? And anyways, this is completely out of the blue. I'm not spontaneous. I like to look before I leap. You go too fast for me, Crowley. Too fast for you. Oh, that's terrific. Really, really brilliant. We've been together for nearly 14 years. How much fucking time do you need? Oh, you know that's not what I mean, isn't it? Then pray tell, Angel, what do you mean? It's one thing to not want to kiss me or take my hand in public, I get that. But Christ's sakes, this? Things are changing. It's not the same as when we first met starting out. You know that as well as I do. But still, you're afraid to even stand in front of a justice of peace and say that you love me? And Crowley begins to get up, not particularly wanting to hear Aziraphale's answer. And Aziraphale is left alone to pack up the sad remains of their lunch. And inside this little picnic basket, he sees that there's a very nice bottle of champagne hidden in the bottle of the basket, along with a small box of chocolate-covered strawberries. Evidence of Crowley's hopes, of his expectations for how this afternoon was supposed to go. The strawberries would stay in their container for far too long, and the champagne would later get shoved to the back of a cupboard and forgotten for another 15 years. 2 weeks later, Crowley moved out. Aziraphale came home that evening to discover the flat half empty. Physical evidence of his life with Crowley gone. There had been laughter and warmth and birthdays and forehead kisses and cups of tea and slow dancing in the kitchen, and now there was nothing. Nothing except a half-empty flat echoing with memories and the deep soul-crushing realization that Aziraphale has made the biggest mistake of his life. Even years later, Aziraphale could not explain what had happened to him that day in the park. He should have said yes. Instead, he said wait. He said let's talk about this. He said slow down. The moment it had mattered most, his courage had failed him. So we're back in 2019, and we're going to stay back in 2019, because that's the end of their story in 2004. Right. So it's the day of the wedding. Crowley shows up at the service, debating on whether or not to leave, but then Adam finds him, and it's too late to turn back now. The child has spotted him. Can't escape the child. Aziraphale is inside already, fussing with Anathema. She's radiant, absolutely excited for her wedding day. And when Aziraphale has deemed her good to go, she pulls him into a hug, thanking him for all his help leading up to this day. And he relaxes into her hug and says, "It was my pleasure." And in that moment, he truly means it. It's a beautiful ceremony and went off without a hitch. The reception is lovely too. Everyone's having a great time. The them are at their own table, glancing between Aziraphale and Crowley. They hadn't so much as looked at each other all night, which was entirely unacceptable for the children. It was time for the next part of their plan. They wriggled their way into the DJ booth to start playing You Take My Breath Away, which, according to Madame Tracy, was Crowley and Aziraphale's song. They sit and wait, but neither man even seems to notice the song change. They begin to worry that their plan wasn't going to work, but then Adam feels a warm hand on his shoulder and looks up to see Madame Tracy. "I'll take it from here, dears." And she gets Aziraphale onto the dance floor, commenting the whole time about how romantic this whole place looks, the energy, the mood of everything. And while they talk, Madame Tracy gets them closer to Crowley until she can get him to take over for her. And before either can refuse or even know what's going on, they're dancing. But neither moves away from each other either, and they end up in a slow, easy rhythm. "It was a lovely ceremony," Aziraphale says. "Although I do believe this is the last time I play wedding planner. I dare say the whole thing's taken years off my life." And Crowley says, "Bit ironic though, isn't it? You ending up as a wedding planner after everything." Crowley, "Don't." "Don't what? I'm just making an observation." And Aziraphale, very hurt by this comment, leaves the wedding hall. He can't fully leave. He promised to help with the cleanup process, but he can stay out of Crowley's eyesight until he leaves. He's at the bottom of the stairs when the door swings open, Crowley at the door. "For the record, I wasn't following you," he says, "just going home." Aziraphale doesn't say anything as Crowley walks past him to the parking lot, but then Crowley stops. "It should have been us." "What?" "It should have been us." Aziraphale's heart doesn't know whether to sink or soar. "What do you mean?" "You know damn well what I mean. That should have been us back there, with the sappy speeches and the drunk relatives and the happily ever afters. We should have been the lovesick idiots slow dancing to some god-awful Celine Dion song, not the miserable bastards out in the cold." "Don't you think I know that already? Don't you think I know that would have been us if I hadn't been such a cowardly idiot? If I hadn't been so stupid as to let you get away?" The admission slips out of Aziraphale, as if something deep inside him has cracked wide open and was now spilling its contents into the empty air. "And I know you delight in tormenting me, coming into my shop and serving me a constant reminder to the worst mistake of my entire life. What are you?" Aziraphale's completely crying. "But I'm not as strong as you, Crowley. I haven't been able to move on like you have, and I suspect I never will, so please stop. Just stop. Leave me be." "You're so clever. How can you be so clever and yet so stupid?" And then there's a pair of warm, achingly familiar hands on Aziraphale. "Aziraphale, for the past 10 years, I have been paying the postman to regularly slip me a piece of your mail by accident just so I can have an excuse to come into your shop. For the first few years, I was just waiting. Figured that you would come around eventually. Then I realized that you weren't going to, and things kind of got bad for a while. And then finally I realized that I couldn't not have you in my life, even if you were just rolling your eyes at me and telling me to leave." And Aziraphale's mind spins, trying desperately to understand how this could possibly ever be true. He flashed back to all the times Crowley had popped into his shop, and in hindsight, he realizes how flimsy some of the excuses had been, but he had been so caught up in his own pain and anxiety to realize. "But I broke your heart." "I mean, yeah, but it's still yours. Always has been. I meant it when I said that you had me from the beginning. You're stuffy and uptight and can be more than a bit of a bastard sometimes, but there will never, ever be anyone else for me. It's you, and it always has been you." Aziraphale's tears had begun to freely flow again. How many times had he imagined this moment, prayed to hear those very words? It's almost too much. He raises his hands to cup Crowley's elbows. He needs to reach out, to touch and prove that this is real. Oh, my love, I'm so sorry. The simple apology seems so weak in the face of it all. In the face of all that happened between the two of them, but Crowley pulls him into a tight hug. Me too, Angel. Me too. They stay like that for several long moments until the front door of the hall swings open. A couple of women step out, glancing in their direction. The significance of this moment is not lost on Aziraphale, but here, in this moment, he doesn't give a damn who sees them. What was that perceived safety worth if it meant continuing to live without his love? Could we try again? I'd like very much for us to be, well, I'd like us to be an us again. I want that too. You have no idea how much I want that. But if we do that, I have to know that it's real. I don't think I can handle losing you again. Aziraphale lowers his hands to Crowley's chest, smoothing his lapel and straightening his crooked boutonniere. Forget me nots. A symbol of good memories and true love, a lifelong connection and fidelity, the exact kind of sign Aziraphale had prayed for 1,000 times over. But looking at Crowley, Aziraphale realizes that he couldn't care less if it was a sign. A sign would indicate fate, some sort of ineffable plan that they were just taking part in. This was free will, a clear choice to be made, and this time he was choosing Crowley. What if I answered your question? What question? The one you asked me 15 years ago. I never did give you my answer. If the offer still stands, my answer is yes. Yes what? Yes, I will marry you. Hang on, who said anything about marriage? I distinctly remember asking you for a civil partnership. Marriage seems a bit fast, don't you think? On the contrary, darling, I'd say it's long overdue. And with that, he tugs on Crowley's lapels and pulls him into a kiss. Home. There was no other way to describe it. Kissing Crowley was like coming home after a long journey, an overwhelming sense of comfort and familiarity that made him feel warm all over. It was a little bit awkward, of course, with some bumping of teeth and noses. Age had softened Aziraphale's frame and further sharpened Crowley's, but they still fit together like two perfectly cut puzzle pieces. Do I really get to marry you? I take back what I said about not wanting to plan another wedding. I think I've got one more in me. And inside the hall, Madame Tracy shoos the children away from the window, though she herself pauses for a moment to watch. The Reverend Shadwell is at her side. You'll officiate their wedding for them, won't you? Reverend Shadwell, who had warmed considerably to Aziraphale in the past few seconds, nodded. Of course, of course. It's about time someone made an honest man out of Mr. Fell. And that is Ink Blots and Forget Me Nots by Guts and Glitter. A Wobble Wedding. Wow. So sweet. I really like this. Thank you to the Good Omens fandom for writing great fan fiction. I appreciate it. I liked it. It was rough. I'm glad that it was as short as it is, because there is something about pain that I can't take for a certain amount of time. Mm. I need good. Yeah. I need good, you know? I need good. And I'm glad that they gave me good in the middle when, like, they first got together. And you're like, great. I feel great about this. And then I don't feel great.
Interesting.
And then the very next chapter, I feel fine again. Everything is good.
Me prolonged. So slip the knife into me slowly and then twist it once it's fully inside.
I need to be okay.
Lemon juice and salt.
I need to be okay immediately afterwards.
Put some leeches in there, maggots.
There is an epilogue. Chapter 12 takes place in the summer of 2021.
Whoa.
There's cute. It's very sweet. It's very short. It's about their little life. I love it a lot. They're very sweet. It's a very sweet little fic. It does remind me of the show where, like, it's just a very short.
Right.
Yeah. And I really liked with the fic that, like, they had, obviously, in the middle pieces with Aziraphale's mentor, Gabriel, saying all those very awful things.
Right.
Right? And then at the end, you have a reverend who just did the wedding of this straight couple who are like, oh, yeah, I'd absolutely 100% do their wedding. Absolutely, I would officiate their wedding in a heartbeat. Which, like, I really enjoy because on one, it shows, like, the change within some individuals within the Catholic Church. Because, yeah, there are safe people within the Catholic Church, not everybody, right? Which is, I think, a really very sweet way to show that, like, that is changing from 1990 to 2019, right? Like, mm-hmm. that has changed. And also just, like, there are people that you will find who will love you within that. Where it's, like, even up until that point in the fic, where it was just, like, Aziraphale was even like, oh, this was a sign. And he was like, I don't need it to be a sign. Like, but it's still always going to be there, right? Where it's, like, I think for a lot of people our age and older, like, millennial age, like, I think a lot of us grew up Catholic or Christian in some regard. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's more shocking that somebody didn't grow up religious.
Yeah. Or even, like, I don't know. Especially for me, it was, like, I was vaguely jealous of people who did not grow up actively going to church mm-hmm. every Sunday. Because I was forced to go to church yeah. every Sunday for at least 2 hours, right. if not three. Mm-hmm. On top of doing, like, once you turn 12, you would go every Wednesday night and do, like, activities.
Like youth group?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was, like, an hour and a half, yeah. sometimes 2 hours. On top of, like, occasionally going to camps mm-hmm. or, like, special events that happen every couple years, like, I think it's a well-known fact that I grew up Mormon. Mm-hmm. They opened a temple by where we live, yeah. and my ward, quote-unquote, was within the region that the temple was opening for, so we had to learn all of these special, like, celebration mm-hmm. things and, like, perform for the, whatever the head bishop is called. Right. I can't fucking remember.
That's all right.
President of the church, and, like, it was a big deal, and we also did, like, this thing called trek. Like, there was a bunch of things that I just happened... My age just happened to allow me to, like, be a part of all these things, and it was kind of, like, one thing after another mm-hmm. after another. And then finding out that some of my closest friends growing up were like, oh, yeah, like, we're religious, but not, like,
yeah,
Bible thumpers. And right. it's like, God damn it. Fuck. I think my religious perspective might have been very different.
Sure.
If if I weren't so heavily in it, like, I don't think that I would have been Mormon still, but mm-hmm. if my parents were just like, oh, Jesus, sort of, kind of, yeah. I think things would have been different for right. me. But I don't know, you know, like, this is the life that I've led. There's right. nothing that I can change that has happened. Mm-hmm. So I am who I am because of what I've been through. And I feel like that's a comfort mm-hmm. for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Religion wise. And I think the show Good Omens was, like, at least for me, it was, like, a good way to, like, get a different view on religion mm-hmm. and be like, okay, well, like, yeah, it's, like, it's stupid and it can be yes. funny and, like, not be taken so mm-hmm. seriously.
Yeah.
Religion's a funny thing, and I think people need to, like, take it less seriously, and it's easy for me to say that.
For sure.
I think, instead of people who are, like, Bible thumpers been yeah. going to church for 72 years right. and shit like that.
Or even people like, again, like Aziraphale, who, like, his whole life was dedicated to right. that, right? Where, like, I part of, like, the dialogue when Crowley was asking to marry him was just like, well, I never thought I'd get married in the first place. Like, I was studying to become a priest, which doesn't exactly lead to marriage either. Mm-hmm. And then Aziraphale is just like, or not Aziraphale, Crowley is just like, I thought we'd move past this, but, like, to somebody like Aziraphale, who dedicated his whole life to that, there's just no easy way to move past that. Mm-hmm. Differently to somebody who just, like, oh, yeah, like, I went to church when I was younger, and I left when I was younger, or whatever. Like,
right.
that is even more completely different than someone who just, like, even was just, like, a Bible thumper, went to church for 72 years. I'm just like, oh, no, that was just gonna be his whole life. That he had right. to upend, because...
Yeah. I mean, you learn things about yourself. You learn and you grow, and
yeah,
life's about the decisions. And
yeah. I love fan fiction because, like, where else am I going to have, like, a religious trauma, getting back together after 15 years, flower shop, tattoo shop?
Yeah.
Thick, right? Real. Like, where am I going to get that?
I'm not going to see that in the news.
No, I'm not. I'm not going to see that on Barnes & Noble, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I'm not going to get that anywhere else. For That's sure. an archive of our own specific, you know what I mean? Like, everything I'm looking for, you know? Religious trauma, check. Flower shop, tattoo shop, check.
Right.
A bunch of children playing God to get two men to love each other again, check.
Right.
Great. We didn't even talk about that. I loved them, that whole fic. They're just mm-hmm. like, this is our plan. I was 100% going in the route of, like, oh my god, this woman's not even getting married. This whole thing is, like, they're planning a wedding for them. They're gonna get to the wedding, and they're gonna push them there and be like, surprise, this is actually your wedding. This woman's not even getting married. But no, she actually got married. But that's how I was going the entire fit, going like, oh, they're gonna, that's gonna be their wedding. This is gonna be their wedding. I was waiting at the end of my seat, especially when like he rejected the wedding, the marriage proposal. I was like, it's absolutely happening. This is gonna be their wedding. No.
No.
I'm not that much of a psychic. But I really thought the entire time that's exactly how that was gonna happen. But I'm still like, I'm happy how it came out. I'm mad that I didn't see their wedding. Time skipped all the way to the end. But again, glad that it's a happily ever after. Glad that it was short enough for me not to be hurt the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
Not into that. But yeah, I enjoyed it so much. Thank you, Archive of Our Own, for housing this perfection. Ooh. This beautiful content of like, where else am I going to find this? Nowhere else. Thanks, Gods and Glitter, for writing it. Very good. Thanks to the Good Omens. I might start checking out Good Omens fanfiction more because I'm really interested in what you guys got going on over there. And I hope for more fanfiction within the second season. For sure.
Oh, it's coming.
Oh, it's absolutely coming. We don't know what's, again.
Right.
This has not been written before. They're not doing the book anymore.
Right.
What's going to happen? No one knows.
Guess we'll see.
Topsy-turvy. We're here now. And I'm looking forward to the fanfiction that comes out of it. Thank you for listening to another episode of Canonically Incorrect. You can follow us on Twitter and TikTok and Instagram and Tumblr. You can send us your fanfiction recommendations, or if you're a fanfiction author that would like to be on our show, email us at canonicallyincorrectpod@gmail.com. If you would like to support us, you can donate a one-time donation at ko-fi.com/canonicallyincorrect. You can subscribe to our Patreon monthly at patreon.com/canonicallyincorrect. Thank you to our Patreons, Autumnal River and Riley C, for your continued support.
Donate to AO3!
And we'll see you guys next time!
Bye! Bye.